It's Friday, May 21st, day 4 of the Penn World Voices Festival of International Literature. I'm Stephen Fee, and this is a special festival edition of the Penn Pod, a podcast from Penn America. On today's edition, Sharks in the Time of Saviors, a novel about one family's quest for survival, we have an interview with Penn Hemingway Award winner Kavai Strong Washburn. Then, what's coming up at the festival? I'm Stephen Fee. All that coming up on this special edition of the Penn Pod. Myths, magic, and storytelling, our Vivian Eng has that interview.
Kavai Strong Washburn is the author of Sharks in the Time of Saviors, a story of a family pushed to the edge of precarity in the wake of the Hawaiian sugarcane industry collapse and a series of mysterious divine disruptions. He is the winner of the 2021 Penn Hemingway Award for Debut Novel and the 2021 Minnesota Book Award. Kavai Strong Washburn, thanks for joining us for this special Penn World Voices Festival episode of the Penn Pod.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
All right, so let's get started with your debut. What did it mean for you to publish your novel and receive an award for it during such a tumultuous time?
It was really difficult. I don't know what it feels like normally because I don't have anything to compare it to, but I do know that there are so many things that have happened over the last year that have been very painful to witness, and so many moments of fear and anger and frustration. And I've been so emotionally taxed on all those fronts that I don't know that I had anything left really to give to celebrating some of the awards. And I think a lot of it doesn't feel real because everything has been so virtual. So I think the combination of those two things, having been very emotionally drained over the last year and having everything happen virtually, that doesn't always feel very real. And so I think that some of the joy that I might have experienced otherwise just hasn't been there. But I'm hopeful that it'll happen soon, that I'll start to feel happier about some of these things.
Well, speaking of time, you've said before that your book took over 10 years to write. Can you tell us about what first inspired the book and how the story grew from there?
Yeah, so the initial image, which you see at the tail end of the first chapter, was this image of a child being saved from drowning by a shark. I don't know where the image came from, and it's the first time as far as any sort of writing I've done where the image or the inciting image or desire to write the thing, the seed, I guess, if you will, that was the first time it came from something that I couldn't really place. So I don't usually attribute any sense of serendipity or magic to writing particularly, but for whatever reason, this image just popped into my head one day. I let it sit there for a while though. I let it sit there for probably a year or so, but it kept coming back. I would be washing the dishes or taking a shower or standing in line at the grocery store or waiting for the bus, and the image would pop back up. And it happened enough that I started asking questions about it. And that's when I started to think about the family, right? Because the first thing I think of a lot of times when I think of children is I think about their family as well. And so a lot of the initial questions after the image had to do with family. And from there, it started to feel like something that was rich enough to be some sort of a story. And then I quickly realized it was big enough in terms of its scope that it would probably turn into a novel. And that was when I started thinking about writing it as a novel.
Thank you for sharing that. There are so many elements of the supernatural, the mythic, and the magical in this amazing book, which is about one family's resilience and quest towards survival. What for you is the connection between folklore, magic, and survival?
So I think on the one hand, there is often a function of myth, folklore, tales passed down through generations that have an element of, if not a moral, there's some bigger thing at work that is trying to be expressed through those stories that relates to perhaps the way that a person should treat another person or the implications of a character flaw, whether that's something like greed or slothfulness or things like that. So there's that element of it that I think can often be contained. But when I think about oral histories, I think about the living history of a people being contained in that. And so for me, the idea of the survival being associated with that is it is literally the breath of the entire people is contained in those stories when they're passed from person to person. And so when I think of mythology, particularly in this context, I also think of hula, which is one of the reasons it also takes a central place in this novel, because I consider that to be, in many ways, that is like the living, like that is the soul of the islands, in my opinion. And I've certainly had experiences dancing hula and participating in hula that I can feel something bigger than myself working through me. And I know that that probably sounds like I'm, you know, off in my own space talking about something strange, but I actually have felt that. And so I think when I think of mythology, I think of it the same way. I think of that hula as just sort of this living, breathing embodiment of the spirit of an entire people, right? The ancestral line of a people.
Yeah. And what you're saying about oral histories and mythologies is a wonderful segue to our next question. You grew up in Hawaii, but you aren't a native Hawaiian. Your main characters in Sharks in the Time of Saviors are. Could you talk more about writing from the perspective of the witness versus on an experience you might have had firsthand? What advice do you have for writers who are writing on cultures that they might have a deep affinity toward, but are not necessarily their quote unquote own?
Yeah, so I think the first place we can start certainly is with the question of, which you put it in quotation marks, own, right? So I think first of all, anytime anybody wants to write beyond their identity, or even in the sense of the perception of what a person's identity is, because I think we need to recognize that many of the identities that we consider as these static, quote unquote, natural things are socially defined and arbitrary. Race is a perfect example of that, right? Like race is something that is a social construct that was created to perpetuate certain power systems, right? And so the idea of race itself is something that, to the extent one doesn't want to feel contained within that, there's a space, I think, for that to be a very valid response in art. But outside of things like race, there are still some categories that are ones that exist with boundaries or things that are worth thinking about. And I think that a sense of like culture and community, although we can't easily define those are things that have what feel to me like certain boundaries. And you can be somebody that is from a place or of a community, and the experience of being that person can be very different than if you are somebody that's observing that particular community or place from outside of it. Having said all of that, I think that for me, the initial question of what should somebody write, what underlies that are two things people are concerned about when somebody writes beyond their identity. One is that they are perpetuating problematic ideas about this quote unquote other that are being informed by their own biases, by the disconnect between those two identities. So for instance, if you're somebody that's white, right? And when we talk about racial terms, I really don't like using these terms, so we'll just go ahead and use them. Like if you're somebody that's white and you want to write about somebody that's black, there's immediately going to be this risk that there are a lot of things that you don't understand intrinsically about what it means to be black that you may or may not even realize is the case as somebody who is white, right? So there's this concern that you're really far from the truth of that other, quote unquote. And I think that there are problems in that. The other risk is a lot of people are concerned that you're exploiting a power imbalance for the purposes of your own personal gain, or by telling this story or by doing this thing for a race that's beyond your own, what you're doing is you're taking a platform you have access to as somebody with more power and using that to strip a story from somebody else and take it as your own and gain fame or notoriety for things like that. Those are kind of the two at a high level things I think a lot of people think about when they think about writing outside of your identity. And I think that the question of a witness versus a person within it is a difficult one because it assumes that there's something intrinsic about a specific individual, if we're talking about, say, for instance, a race, that can't be experienced or thought of by somebody that isn't of that same group, which isn't the case. And I'll give you a quick example. So for instance, I have friends that I've had for years that grew up in inner city, like housing project, ghetto communities that are white, right? And they understand things about those communities even though they're not of what would be perceived as the only racial category that may or may not be able to talk about those things, right? And so for me, I think sometimes when we have this reaction of, let's say if we were to take that example and kind of follow it through, we would say, well, a white person can never talk about what it's like to be black living in a ghetto. And you're like, well, what if they live in that ghetto with you, right? What if that is their community? What if all they've ever known? So is it really always an issue about race? And, you know, for myself, I'm half black. And if I wrote a story about a black person in an inner city ghetto or something like that, I think a lot of people wouldn't necessarily bat an eye. But do I, having not been born and raised in that situation, I have to do some work to come to that place and understand the reality of being in that space before I could write about it. But there probably wouldn't be anybody that in the end would say, oh, you don't get to write about that. And that's because there's a perception that for some reason, I being Black as part of this arbitrary racial category, get access to this community, even though I'm not necessarily a member of it, right? And so there's a lot of things that come up that are very, very problematic that I think there's not easy to draw well-defined boundaries. And so I think when people want to write beyond their identity, the main thing they need to do is, first of all, they need to ask themselves why they're doing that. Is it because of some sense of weird? You know, is there a exoticizing of some culture you're unfamiliar with, or a fascination for it that's driven by something that is potentially problematic? Or is it being written from a perspective of you're trying to write a story that expands beyond the boundaries of your identity? And if it's the latter, I think there's nothing wrong with that. But you also need to do the work to really understand the things you're writing about. And this goes for so many different categories, right? I'm a man, and every time I get ready to write, I identify as male. And anytime I get ready to write about a gender identity beyond the one that is the one that I identify with, I recognize that before I start and think about what I need to be paying very close attention to when I'm rendering a character from a gender that's different than my own, to check any biases that I might still be carrying that might make me render that thing in a way that reinforces power imbalances rather than destroying them, right? And I think the same way about all the different identity groups that are in society today that result in power imbalances. And if you do that work as an artist, right, if you recognize, first of all, that you're writing outside of your identity, and that means there's both a responsibility and a challenge there, and you meet both of those things, and you know that the reason you're doing it is a good one and isn't a problematic one, then I think within those two things, you have the freedom to push yourself beyond your boundaries. And I also look to all of the art that has come before me that I have found powerful and valuable and enriching, that has come from artists that have worked outside of the boundaries of their identities. And there's plenty of examples of that. And I think that I see all of those examples and I say that, yes, this is possible. And it's important and can be good and can do good things. And with all of those other caveats in mind, it can certainly be undertaken. It's also one of those sorts of things that we're never going to have a perfect answer to that question. People will continue to ask it and people continue to have different answers. And it's the sort of question I think we all have to just accept. And I think we just have to be very thoughtful in the way that we engage in the work as artists.
Yeah, thanks for such a nuanced, thoughtful answer. Today, you're going to be speaking with Yemen Manai and Jordi Napka in the Ties That Bind panel, which delves into global crises of our interconnected world and how the characters in each of your books confront them. What are you particularly looking forward to discussing with your fellow panelists?
Yeah, it's one of the things I'm always interested in learning about is just having an education on new perspectives that I haven't encountered. And both of their work is speaking to things that I haven't ever read before. And so having a sense of their perspective on the world today from their location and how some of the things that I've experienced where I am can be thought of in a totally different light. And I can come away from that with a fresh understanding of how to look at any given situation. Sometimes there can be these things we attach ourselves to as the dominant narrative that can turn out to be totally different when a less well-represented group is able to come to the table and speak about those things. It can totally change the narrative. And so I'm hoping that in our panel, I get a chance to have those sorts of experiences where people will bring perspectives on different situations and ideas about where the world is now and where it's going that are totally different from my own. And I love that. I love hearing new things that challenge and change my understanding of the world.
Thanks for sharing that, Kabai. And thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, it was my pleasure.
Kavai Strong Washburn is the author of Sharks in the Time of Saviors, which he'll be discussing today at 1 p.m. Eastern, 12 p.m. Central in the Penn World Voices Festival event, The Ties That Bind, Weathering Crises in a Globalized World. Get your tickets now at penn.org/festival.
Now for a look at the day ahead for the festival. Catch Kavai in conversation with Jordi Napka and Yemen Manai on The Ties That Bind, Weathering Crises in a Globalized World. That's at 1 p.m. Eastern, 10 a.m. Pacific. Tonight, hear about The Art of the Memoir with Rhonda Girard and Mortada Gazar. And on Saturday, don't miss conversations on familial inheritance, Black abundance, and radical love, and our closing night Arthur Miller lecture with Tasmanian novelist and Booker Prize winner Richard Flanagan. Tickets are on sale right up until the last minute. And that's our episode for Friday, May 21st. Join us tomorrow for our last and final special festival episode of the Pen Pod. We'll have a conversation with author Brian Broom. Tickets for the festival are on sale now. Head to our website, pen.org/festival, to buy. I'm Stephen Fee for Pen America. This is a special festival edition of the Pen Pod. See you tomorrow.